Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 322, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on August 26th of the year 2001. In For the Record program number 321, The Return of Il Duce Part 2, we were talking about Silvio Berlusconi, the Prime Minister of Italy, and we were talking about the connections between Silvio Berlusconi and the Propaganda Due Lodge, a bogus Masonic lodge, which functioned as, in effect, a crypto-fascist government that not only ran Italy for much of the post-war period, in effect anyway, but continues to wield profound influence. Silvio Berlusconi, as discussed in numerous broadcasts, was a member of the P2 Lodge. In RFA number 19, we dealt with a strategy of tension, a program of terror from both the right and the left being managed by elements of the intelligence service, such as the Super Seize Me, a group of Italian intelligence officers associated with the P2 and of fascist orientation. And the strategy of tension incorporated a number of different elements, including elements of the CIA and Western intelligence during the Cold War period. Late in For the Record program number 321, we dealt with a bombing that took place in Venice, and we also reviewed the fact that the Ordine Nuovo, or New Order, an Italian fascist terrorist group set up by Pino Rauti, himself a veteran of the Salo Republic, the rump fascist state that was set up in northern Italy by the Nazis after Mussolini was rescued by them. And Pino Rauti was part of the coalition that Silvio Berlusconi put together in order to come to power in Italy. We're going to begin this broadcast with an examination of the reprise in Italian terror, because it would appear, to a certain extent at least, that Italy is going forward into the past. I guess one could say, quoting the words of the immortal Yogi Berra, deja vu all over again. Of the Venice bombing that we dealt with at the end of For the Record program number 321, the Wall Street Journal wrote as follows in its edition of Friday, August 10th of the year 2001. I would note that in discussing this particular bombing, the mayor of Venice specifically used the term strategy of tension. And again, that's a term that is very well known to veteran listeners to this program. Those of you who listened in the 80s heard a lengthy discussion of the strategy of tension, and it's discussed in numerous For the Record programs as well, most recently in For the Record program 321. Again, the Wall Street Journal of Friday, August 10th of 2001 has the following story by Yaroslav Trofimov of the Wall Street Journal. This is headlined, "Bomb Explodes in Venice, Casting a Pall." It reads in part as follows. Italy was threatened with a return to the dark days of terrorism as a powerful bomb ripped through the Venice courthouse in yesterday's early morning hours, destroying several stores and shattering windows across the city shortly before a visit by Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. Law enforcement officials would say only that a sophisticated bomb was used, but both government and opposition politicians linked the blast, which slightly injured two guards, with the violence between anti-globalization demonstrators and police at last month's Genoa summit of the Group of Eight leading nations. Skipping down, quote, "Italy has already experienced this strategy of tension in the past when it was used by extremists on both sides," unquote, Venice Mayor Paolo Costa said in an interview. There has been a recent terror bombing in Italy as well, this one directed at the right, and this one directed specifically at the Liga Nord, or Northern League, part of the reactionary-slash-fascist coalition put together by Silvio Berlusconi. Most American newspapers barely covered this bombing, if at all. There was, fortunately, better coverage in the Financial Times of Friday, August 24th of the year 2001. This article is by Jo Johnson in Rome. Her first name, by the way, J-O. It's headlined, "Parties Suspect One Another Over Italian Bombing." And once again, we're going to see the term strategy of tension used in this article. This, however, by the Financial Times writer, Jo Johnson. And we're also going to examine speculation that perhaps there has been a return to the past in Italy. That obviously is what I've been speculating for some time. Speculating about, I should say. This article reads in part, "A bomb exploded in an office of the right-wing Northern League in a small town near Padua early yesterday, less than a month after a courthouse was bombed in Venice. The attacks have led some government members to claim that the country is facing a campaign to destabilize the new administration of Silvio Berlusconi, Prime Minister." Quote, "The League had predicted these bombs," said Roberto Castelli, Justice Minister and Northern League politician. Quote, They are terrorist acts against change, unquote. The night before the bomb, Umberto Bossi, Northern League leader, was quoted as saying the left wanted, quote, to profit from terrorism in order to reverse electoral results, unquote. Mr. Berlusconi has spoken of a, quote, worrying escalation of violence, unquote, aimed at the Italian government. But others have suggested Italian intelligence services may be reviving a strategy of tension, unquote, the term given to suspected collusion between parts of the Italian state, fascist terrorists, and provocateurs in the 1970s to discredit the left. Lawyers for the Genoa Social Forum, an umbrella group for anti-globalization groups, say they have evidence of links between hooligans and police. The inclusion in the government of the Northern League, which was once committed to the breakup of the Italian state, and of the National Alliance, which has its origins with Italy's fascist past, has also been cited as a possible cause of recent bombs. Responsibility for the bomb in Venice and a fake one found last week at Rome's busy Termini railway station has been claimed by various groups, including at least one that said it was a spin-off from the Red Brigades, the militant group notorious for kidnapping and murdering Aldo Moro, a former prime minister, in 1978. Yesterday's bomb injured no one. Well, again, the speculation is obviously being voiced by various parties, including the mayor of Venice and also a number of other Italian political observers, that in fact the bad old days, described I think fairly accurately in this Financial Times article, the bad old days of the strategy of tension are returning once again. And that really should not come as a great surprise if in fact that's what's taking place, and I certainly think that viewpoint deserves serious consideration in light of the forces that have come to power in Italy. Berlusconi himself was a member of the P2 Lodge of Licio Gelli, the liaison officer between the Hermann Goering Division and Italian fascists himself, Gelli that is, a veteran of the Salo Republic and a prime mover in Italian fascism, not only during World War II, but afterward as well. Among his nicknames in Italian political lexicon are Il Venerabile and the Puppet Master, the Venerated One and the Puppet Master, which indeed he is. Licio Gelli also has profound connections on this side of the Atlantic. Licio Gelli was an honored guest at Ronald Reagan's inauguration in 1980. An honorary member of the P2 Lodge, the late Philip Guarino, is part of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, literally a fascist element within the Republican Party proper. And Licio Gelli had many connections to powerful elements in the United States, and his P2 Lodge was a prime functionary in the strategy of tension and also part of what a freelance Danish journalist Henrik Kruger called the Fascist International. We dealt with the Red Brigades and their very destructive effect on Italian politics, and an Italian parliamentary commission investigating the Red Brigades found that none other than Licio Gelli was the founder or among the founders of the Red Brigades. That is documented in RFA number 19, dealing with the P2 Lodge and with the strategy of tension. I thought by way of illustrating once again the deja vu all over again, or forward into the past, a theme that we've been dealing with for for the entire time I've been on the air, in that we are, it would appear that not only in the United States but elsewhere, we are returning to the days of fascism. I thought it might be interesting to review a section of RFA 34. RFA 34 was recorded on December 13th of 1987, and in addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. We're going to be dealing with an article from Panorama Magazine from October 4th of 1987. This, by the way, was researched for us by Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator. And the article in question is going to be dealing with Licio Gelli's first period on the run. He twice escaped from Italian custody and ultimately wound up back in the custody of the authorities. Of course, Licio Gelli, to a considerable extent, is the authorities. That's improperly conjugated, but what the hell, you can't win them all. Licio Gelli, following the disclosures concerning the P2 Lodge and its many connections, went on an international flight from Italian justice, and according to Panorama Magazine, in turn accessing a journalist who was very close to Licio Gelli, among his stops while a fugitive from justice was a clinic in Florida. Of course, Florida is in the U.S. of A. He also was in Switzerland, at least for a period of time, and while in Switzerland, he rendezvoused with this journalist, at least according to this journalist, and was dressed in the uniform of a United States Air Force general, which, according to this journalist, had been given to Jaylee by one of his close friends who assisted Jaylee's flight from freedom. That close friend was George Bush, at the time Vice President of the United States. Of course, formerly he'd been director of the CIA during one of the most important periods of the Strategy of Tension and the related Operation Condor in Latin America. And, of course, George Bush later on went on to become President of the United States, and his son, George II, is currently President of the United States. So I thought, by way of highlighting once again the extent to which we have come full circle, we're going to once again revisit RFA 34 from December 13th of 1987. This is from Panorama Magazine of October 4th of 1987. Apart from the ex-Christian Democratic deputy Egidio Carinini, who never hid his friendship with Licio Gelli, journalist and writer Pierre Carpi, or Pietro Carpi, C-A-R-P-I, was the only one in these last 6 years to talk to and meet with the P2 Grand Master during his evasion from justice. With documents provided by Licio Gelli, Carpi even wrote and published a book entitled Il Casa Gelli. Then, from there, Carpi wrote another based on a notebook sent to him by Gelli himself entitled P2 Scandello Nello Scandello, unquote, the publication of which was stopped by the magistrature near the publisher Pironti of Naples. Then, quoting here from that book, it was the spring of 1981. Through his family, Gelli sent precise instructions to me. I must go to Geneva, stay at the Hotel du Rhône, and wait for a phone call. So I did, and after 2 days of waiting, the phone rang. It was Gelli. He told me to leave quickly and to go take a walk by the Long Lake. I remember that it was a beautiful day with few people. I walked for about 2 hours without seeing him and began to get tired. At a certain point, I saw in front of me a group of American soldiers in uniform who were talking among themselves. As I was passing around them, a man in the uniform of a United States Air Force general separated from the group, came towards me and said, "Hey, stupid, don't you recognize me? It was Gelli." Unquote. He told of being a guest of the U.S. ambassador in Switzerland, where he has plenty of protection, thanks to the intervention of George Bush, then and now the Vice President of the United States and his great friend. Unquote. I last spoke with Gelli 7 months ago. He called me on the phone. He had almost lost his voice and told me he had returned from hospitalization in a Florida private clinic. He told me for the umpteenth time that he intended to give himself up.
That, again, from RFA 34 from December 13th of 1987. Licio Gelli, according to that journalist, rendezvoused with him. He was wearing the uniform of a United States Air Force general given to him by someone who had aided him in his flight from justice. That, George, according to that journalist, George Bush, of course, then vice president, formerly CIA director, later president, and now, I guess one could say, president emeritus, to coin a term. One of the topics that I've spoken about many, many times and for quite a few years on this broadcast is the Bormann Organization, named for Reichsleiter Martin Bormann. That is literally the economic and political component of a Third Reich gone underground. It perpetuated itself in mafia-like fashion, utilizing its powerful connections with industrialists and financiers around the world, with powerful corporations, the connections between its security outfit and various intelligence services around the world, including American Intelligence Service, and using its consummate economic power and the retribution of the fiercely loyal cadre of the SS. I am not necessarily stating that the individual discussed in the article I'm about to read is with the Bormann Organization, but this type of very powerful, very wealthy, very mysterious individual is the type of individual one looks at in connection with the Bormann Organization, and there are many, many broadcasts about the Bormann Group available from Spitfire. Time permitting, I will tell you more about that later in the program. Whether or not this individual is working with the Bormann Organization, a Mr. Emile Bernard, or whether he's perhaps a proxy for some organized crime faction, or for some intelligence service, or perhaps a combination of those various things, the news can be very, very interesting indeed. Listen carefully to the following article. This is from the Financial Times of Tuesday, August 7th, of the year 2001. This article is by Andrew Edgecliff Johnson in New York. It's headlined, U.S. Airways Attempts to Unmask Its Mystery Suitor, and it reads in part as follows. U.S. Airways took a break from worrying about its future yesterday to ponder the identity and motives of the little-known investor who claims to want to buy the carrier. Emil Bernard, who chairs an unlisted company called Global Airlines, said on Sunday he would be prepared to offer $1.8 billion or $27 per share in stock and cash for the airline. So again, this Emil Bernard was offering either $1.8 billion or, in another context, $27 per share in stock and cash for the airline. Listen to Mr. Bernard. Listen to the discussion here of Mr. Bernard, a very, very, very mysterious individual indeed. Continuing. Industry executives have been able to find out very little about Global, except that it is an airline with no aircraft. Until last year, Mr. Bernard had made headlines only for an unsuccessful proposal in 1978 to buy the San Francisco Giants baseball team and move it to Washington. Skipping down, speaking of an attempt by Mr. Bernard to buy TWA, James Spragan of Kirkland & Ellis, which acted as TWA's counsel, said, quote, "We were unable to confirm the financial wherewithal of Mr. Bernard's group and, as a result, elected not to proceed with his proposal," unquote. Other people close to TWA said Mr. Bernard's proposed offer to buy TWA was sent on a single sheet of plain paper and stated that if TWA would not accept his terms of $3.75 per share, he would make another offer of $4.75 per share. Skipping down. Mr. Bernard's spokesman, John Scott, has described him as a real estate investor. Regulators said yesterday he had not been granted any prior approval to run an airline. Skipping down. Global said last year it had agreed to buy 450 aircraft from Alliance Aircraft, a startup with no manufacturing plant. Nothing has come of the agreement. Mr. Scott also announced last year that Global would seek an American Stock Exchange listing. The exchange said yesterday there was no application pending. Mr. Bernard has no listed telephone number or website and could not be reached yesterday. So the very mysterious Emil Bernard is someone about whom a great many people, I think, as well as yours truly, have more questions than answers. I'm not saying necessarily that he is a proxy for the Borman Group, but that's certainly one of the possibilities that should be considered in that context. And when one sees a very mysterious but ostensibly at least very wealthy and powerful individual, that's one of the questions you want to ask. He could also, as I said, perhaps be working on behalf of some organized crime faction and or some intelligence service, or perhaps some combination of those various elements. By way of understanding, or fleshing out our understanding of just how powerful the Borman Group is, and the extent to which it has infiltrated itself, become involved economically and institutionally with a great many other corporations, and I don't want to be misunderstood as stating that the food giant ConAgra, a huge American agricultural firm that we're about to talk about, is a Borman group, is a Borman company, excuse me, but it would certainly appear that one of the German companies that was bought up by ConAgra is indeed a Borman company and was basically the outgrowth of capital that was stolen and secreted away by the SS during the Holocaust. More about that in a minute. The following article is from the Los Angeles Times of Saturday, August 18th of the year 2001. This is by Nancy Cleland of the LA Times. It's headlined, "Teamsters Reach Deal with ConAgra, Ending Strike." Subtitled, "Pact is Expected to Be Approved, Resolving Two-Year Dispute at Plant in Salinas." The article reads in part, "A two-year strike that divided a California farm town and forced hundreds of low-wage workers to scramble for jobs elsewhere is ending under a deal announced this week by the Teamsters Union and food giant ConAgra. The strike at an onion and garlic dehydration plant in King City near Salinas was noteworthy for the determination of the employees." And the article goes on to describe that strike at family-owned Basic American Foods, which was later bought by ConAgra. ConAgra has done quite a bit of purchasing, and one of the companies that they purchased was a German firm named Becker GmbH. And that would not only appear to be certainly a Borman company, but one that was founded directly with stolen assets from the Holocaust by the SS. What we're going to do now is to listen to a short section of For the Record program number 305. This was originally recorded in June of 1997, and it is a pair of For the Record broadcasts outlining the basics of the Borman Organization. And again, this is from June of 1997. We're going to begin with our examination of the reality of the Nazi flight capital program with a Wall Street Journal article from April 28th of 1997. This was researched for us by a listener. This is an article entitled, Nazi Money Trail Heats Up 50 Years Later, subtitled, Banks and Nations Are Opening Treasure Trove of Records. It's by Greg Steinmetz of the Wall Street Journal, and it reads in part as follows. According to testimony after World War II, an SS officer named Kurt Becker, B-E-C-H-E-R, collected millions of dollars in gold, banknotes, and jewels from Jews seeking to buy their freedom from the Nazis. After the war, Colonel Becker built a successful Bremen-based grain company, Becker GmbH, now owned by ConAgra Incorporated of the U.S. That, again, from For the Record program number 305. So note that Becker GmbH ultimately was bought out by ConAgra. And that by way of illustrating, again, in a relatively small way, the extent to which many of these overtly Nazi companies, or at least companies with a Nazi genesis, have filigreed themselves, to coin a term, in the industrial and financial structures of many countries' corporate entities, this country in particular. One of the subjects that I've spoken about in numerous broadcasts concerns Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was the first anointed leader of the Palestinian National Movement. He also, in a more sinister incarnation, was a major in the SS and a top Third Reich spy, and also a profound leader in what I have called the Underground Reich, and an individual who has been very much involved with channeling Third World Liberation movements in an anti-American and pro-fascist direction in the world. In the post-war period. Haj Amin al-Husseini is someone I've spoken about at considerable length. I've spoken about Haj Amin al-Husseini in RFA 22 and numerous For the Record broadcasts, most recently in For the Record program number 293. Haj Amin al-Husseini was involved with, among other things, in recruiting a number of Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS divisions, including the 13th Waffen-SS division, or Hanjar division, composed almost exclusively of Bosnian Muslims. One of the members of and recruiters of Hanjar was Alija Izet Begovic, the first president of Bosnia. Another of the divisions recruited by Haj Amin al-Husseini was the Skanderberg division, the 21st Waffen-SS division composed of Kosovar Albanians. And again, that dealt with in a number of broadcasts, including For the Record program number 293. One of the very few public mentions that I've ever seen, or journalistic mentions that I've ever seen, of Haj Amin al-Husseini was carried by, of all publications, the Wall Street Journal, a very, very conservative publication. And Robert Pollack, one of its editorial writers, discussed Haj Amin al-Husseini, but perhaps predictably was somewhat oblique about the precise nature of his services on behalf of the Third Reich. In discussing the rapidly polarizing situation in the Middle East, in which elements of the Israeli right have a political heritage going back to the fascist period, or the period of overt fascism, that discussed in a number of different broadcasts, this article describes the following campaign of liquidation intimidation directed towards moderate Palestinians. This is not a subject that one generally hears much about. Again, from the Wall Street Journal of 8/14/2001, this is an article by Robert L. Pollack. It's headlined, Where Have All the Moderate Palestinians Gone? As Israelis debated how to respond to continued suicide bombings, the Palestinian Authority dealt swiftly over the weekend with two perceived enemies. On Saturday, 43-year-old merchant Munzer Hafnawi was sentenced to death in a Nablus courtroom, and on Sunday in Gaza, Khalid Akka was likewise condemned. Their alleged offense? Providing Israel with information used to track and kill Palestinian militants. That such trials usually occur within a day or so of arrest are measured in hours or even minutes, and are often conducted without any legal counsel for defendants, lawyers are afraid to represent them, doesn't seem to faze many of those complaining about Israel's policy of, quote, assassinations, unquote. But then maybe the six collaborators the PA has sentenced to death in recent weeks could be considered lucky to get any kind of trial at all. An indeterminate number of others, including an Israeli Arab shot last week in the West Bank, have also been killed by vigilantes. In fact, the history of such killings is so long, their number so great, and the definition of collaboration so elastic, often just moderation toward the Jews, that it may not be too much of a stretch to say that the current population of Gaza and the West Bank has been as much radicalized by Arab violence as by Israeli. When Westerners puzzle over why it's so hard for Israel to find moderate interlocutors among the Palestinians, historically among the best educated, most entrepreneurial, and liberal of Arab societies, a sad but simple part of the answer is that a great number of the Palestinian elites who might have filled that role were either killed or persuaded to leave long ago. Those now living prosperously in Europe, America, or the Gulf states have little interest in returning to fight both Israel and Yasser Arafat for this little patch of dry land. The creation of such a situation was exactly the intent of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem and foremost Arab political and religious leader in Palestine under the British Mandate. During the late 1930s, his forces killed hundreds of Jews. But even more important to him was getting rid of any Arabs who might tolerate a Jewish presence. Many were killed, often in mass executions. Others fled. And that one of the very few journalistic references I've ever seen to Haj Amin al-Husseini. We revisited the Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS heritage that is making itself felt in the Balkans once again, and specifically some of the SS heritage of Muslim fighting formations in the Balkans, such as some of the Bosnian Muslim formations, and also some of the ethnic Albanian formations as well. Those ethnic Albanian formations have been front and center in the news recently, as the situation in Macedonia has been heating up, and the allegation was made by the Hamburger Abendblatt that U.S. advisors were helping the Albanian rebels. The Hamburger Abendblatt of June 29th of the year 2001, or June 28th of the year 2001, contains the following allegation. This is headlined, "Advisors were helping the Albanian rebels." This is available on the website www.ok.mk/news. This is headlined, "The U.S. peacekeepers from Kosovo had a tricky task in neighboring Macedonia. Firstly, they were supposed to transfer 400 Albania guerrilla fighters together with their arms and ammunition from Arecinovo. For 2 weeks, the NLA 113 Brigade was barricaded from there and was defending itself from fierce attacks. The second part of their task was even trickier. Among the rebels that were withdrawing were 17, quote, instructors, unquote, former U.S. officers that provided military training for the rebels. Not only that, the Macedonian security forces claim that 70% of the equipment that the guerrilla fighters took with them are of U.S. production, among which are some of the most sophisticated third-generation night vision devices." And so the allegation there, and I think it may very well be substantive, although I can't confirm it, that in fact, U.S. advisors were actively aiding some of the Albanian rebels that are active in Macedonia. I've alluded to other programs that are available from Spitfire, a CD and tape duplication service. You can reach them at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Their website, spitfirelist.com. Sister station WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs on two websites. Recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older programs are available for download only on a longer website. Both of those are linked to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. That concludes Side A of For the Record program number 322. We'll continue with this in Side 2. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.